Marketplace is supported by Malwarebytes, engineered to deliver a smart defense against zero-day malware, exploits, and ransomware for business, for home. More at malwarebytes.org/marketplace.
Janet Yellen went up to Capitol Hill today for the Fed chair's required twice-a-year appearance before Congress. Didn't take but 20 minutes for somebody to ask her about looking more closely at how the Fed does what it does.
I want to be completely clear that I strongly oppose audit the Fed.
Yeah, well, she would say that, wouldn't she? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life through its affiliated companies in the United States. AllianzUSA.com. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online, with six start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And by Battelle, for 85 years, solving what matters most for consumers, businesses, and the government. Learn more at Battelle.org.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here, everybody. It is the 24th of February, today, Tuesday. Also, as it happens, day one of what is known as Humphrey Hawkins. 2 days worth of congressional testimony by the incumbent chair of the Federal Reserve. Today to the Senate Banking Committee, tomorrow to the House Financial Services Committee. The basic monetary policy through line for Janet Yellen today, that is what the Fed is going to do on interest rates, hasn't really changed all that much since last time we all talked about it. The Fed is still going to be, and this is the key word, patient about when exactly money is going to start getting more expensive. Running a close second to interest in interest rates, though, was something that's become known as Dr. Yellen said in that clip I played up in the open, audit the Fed. A mostly Republican push to open up the Fed's deliberations on interest rates. Transparency in the Fed's operations, Janet Yellen said this morning, was essential. However,
audit the Fed is a bill that would politicize monetary policy.
And besides, she went on, the Fed gets audited plenty.
I brought with me this volume, which contains an independent outside auditors, Deloitte and Touche's audits of our financial statements.
So from Washington to get us going, Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has more on the politics of monetary policy.
Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky came before an audience in Des Moines earlier this month with what might prove to be a reliable applause line as he stumps for his expected run for president.
Anybody here want to audit the Fed? Out to get us.
Yep, that's him asking, does anybody here think the Fed's out to get us? Paul says the Fed's secret monetary policy deliberations should be open to congressional oversight. He says the Fed is more financially distressed than Lehman Brothers was before it collapsed and set off the 2008 financial meltdown. Ted Peters, a former director of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank, says Paul's comparisons are inaccurate because central banks aren't like commercial banks.
We create our own money at the Fed.
That is to say, commercial banks can overextend themselves by lending too much, while central banks, especially ours, can't, because they're the ones printing the money. He says the worst thing you could do would be to politicize monetary policy and have Congress get more involved.
They can't balance a budget. They can't pass laws. They're running huge deficits. I mean, can you imagine them getting involved in monetary policy?
David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution, says the Fed was in fact designed to be separate from congressional meddling, and for decades it worked largely behind closed doors.
There was a view among economists that monetary policy worked best if it always surprised the public.
But that has changed in the past 30 or so years. The Fed's mission remains the same, to ensure broad employment and price stability, but now it is comparatively shouting its plans to raise interest rates. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Wouldn't you love to hear Janet Yellen actually shout? That'd be some news, right? There was, as it happens, some news on home prices this morning. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index, by name. It gave us more evidence that as the economy keeps on improving, so too do home prices. Up an average of almost 4.5% last year. That's for existing homes, by the way, not new construction. It does sound like a housing market recovery, except that most of the other housing numbers out there, like home sales and housing starts, yeah, not quite so much. It's kind of a mystery, actually. Unemployment is falling, interest rates are low, so why, oh why, is the housing sector still struggling? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that.
Existing home sales are doing all right, and that's a nice thing. But an existing home doesn't help GDP like a brand new home. And a lot of new homes aren't being built because people aren't buying them. Why not? Let's ask friendly random person Phil Littman on a street in Manhattan.
It's exceedingly expensive, and I don't have the financial capability to do that.
Phil Littman is random, but he's pretty typical.
I mean, if I had an unlimited source of financing, I'd rather buy, yes. But in my current situation right now, I'd rather rent.
It's basically just that, if you ask Mark Willis, executive director of NYU's Furman Center. A lot of people don't have a lot of money.
There are parts of the market that is having to deal with relatively stagnant incomes.
Millennials especially face financial instability. Chris Mayer teaches real estate at Columbia Business School.
People are getting married later, and they're having kids later, and they're settling down later.
That's why you see the renter construction rate still up and up pretty dramatically, over 20% over the year.
Susan Wachter is professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School. People are renting, not just because buying is expensive, but borrowing is still hard.
The uneven recovery in construction is fundamentally reflecting tight credit conditions.
Yes, interest rates may be low. That doesn't mean you're going to get a loan. But as much as we like to pin our dismal housing sector on the recession that just won't die, the reality is there were changes in housing happening way before the recession.
Home ownership actually peaked in 2004, before the recession. In fact, before the clear boom in housing peaked.
David Blitzer manages S&P Dow Jones Index Committee. They oversee the Case-Shiller Index. He says the recession may have just accelerated a trend that was happening anyway. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, 3 in the green, y'all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a great essay in the New York Times the other day about the winter that Boston and much of New England is having. A slow-motion natural disaster of historic proportions, it said, where roads are impassable, houses are collapsing, and public transit has been paralyzed. In point of fact, the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, the T in the vernacular, has been partially or entirely shut down for basically most of the past month, which means, for most of the past month, a whole lot of people have been late for work day in and day out, if they get there at all. From WGBH in Boston, Rupa Shenoy reports.
Exasperated Boston residents agree it's tough to get anywhere these days and don't even think about getting there on time. 65-year-old Kenneth Williams takes the bus to his job as a detox counselor and over the past few weeks has regularly been an hour late.
The management looks at me like, what's up again? Again?
Williams' bus ride takes twice as long because traffic on snow-constricted roads moves at a crawl. The trains are no better. Many of the above-ground lines aren't running. Punishing weather has broken so many parts of the archaic transit system that officials say it'll take a month to recover. That all adds up to
total frustration on the part of both employees and employers.
Paul Guzzi is president of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He says the impact on Boston's businesses has been significant. The economic research firm IHS estimated the Massachusetts economy is taking a $265 million hit every day this lasts.
Some employers have allowed their workers to work from home, those particularly who have technology that allows for that.
But of course, technology doesn't help the many businesses that need employees on site. Kevin Long is executive chef of Red Lantern, an Asian restaurant downtown.
Challenges have been overwhelming.
Like many employers whose workers get paid by the hour, Long says when his employees don't show up, he can't pay them. But he's trying to be flexible and understanding.
We've put employees in Ubers and, you know, taken care of taxis and, you know, carpooled and picked people up, dropped them off.
Long says that didn't always work.
You know, obviously, we've had some days that we've had to close. We hate to close. You know, you hate to shut the doors to people that might be trying to get out.
While there's no law against laying people off for not being able to get to work, Professor Tom Cohen of the MIT Sloan School of Management says if employers go that route, it might backfire.
I think these times are testing the bonds between employers and workers. And I think in the majority of cases, it is strengthening those bonds. But in some cases, it may fray them if one party or the other thinks the other is taking advantage of the situation.
These times are also testing the bonds between businesses and their customers. Bright Horizons Family Solutions, one of the state's largest employers, provides backup emergency child care for employees of places like hospitals and law firms. CEO David Lissy says to keep that service going over the past few weeks, Bright Horizons found alternatives to public transportation for its own workers.
Times like this really are times for us to shine and really engender a lot of loyalty with our clients.
And for those companies that can't shine just now, they're soldiering on with the hope that winter will soon end. In Boston, I'm Rupa Shenoy from Marketplace.
The Environmental Protection Agency wants to clear up some misunderstandings. The EPA has sent a note to carmakers that says, in essence, in case any of this wasn't clear before, here are some details about how we measure fuel efficiency. Kia, Hyundai, Ford, and Mercedes have gotten in trouble for reporting miles per gallon for their cars that didn't quite match up with consumer experiences or with EPA checkups. Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains it's all in how you choose to measure reality.
Here's the big surprise about the miles per gallon figures you see on new cars. They're pretty accurate. David Green is a professor at the University of Tennessee and was one of the architects of FuelEconomy.gov. Consumers use that site to report their actual mileage, and he's been looking at how close those thousands of reports are to the official estimates.
They are pretty close, within a couple of percentage points on average. But that's kind of like saying the average family has, 2.6 children. Nobody has 2.6 children.
If you've got a lead foot or you live in the hill country or whatever, well, your mileage will vary. But the numbers reflect the average. It wasn't always this way. In 2008, the EPA changed testing procedures to reflect reality. Byron Bunker runs the compliance division in EPA's Transportation and Air Quality Office.
EPA added test procedures that brought in high-speed driving, that's up to 80 miles per hour, brought in low temperature, that's down to 20 degrees Fahrenheit,
and ran the AC against 95-degree heat. The result? The estimated MPG on most cars dropped by 10 to 20%. This week's guidelines clarify how the EPA simulates the effect of things like friction and drag. Jessica Caldwell is an analyst for Edmunds. She thinks car makers appreciate the EPA's efforts to make sure the numbers are accurate.
Because they don't want people that are disappointed. Because, if I'm disappointed, I'm going to tell probably everybody I know, because we tend to really share bad experiences a lot, sometimes more than positive experiences.
And that's how companies like Hyundai and Kia can get found out. The EPA doesn't check every car. It audits 15 to 20% of new models and checks out some complaints. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think my idea is a good idea. I had a partner who thought it was a good idea, but does the world think it's a good idea?
I don't know, but we're going to find out. I'm going to guess. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 92 points today, about a half percent, closed at 18,209. The NASDAQ added 7 points, a tenth percent, 49.68. The S&P 500 up 5 points, a quarter percent, ended things at 21.15. Record closes for the Dow and the S&P, by the by, in case you keep track of those kinds of things. J.P. Morgan Chase said it's going to thin its consumer and investment banking units as it tries to save 1.4 billion simoleons a year in expenses. Shares in ticker symbol JPM rang up 2.5%. Told you about the housing market a bit earlier in the program. Well, the luxury segment is doing just fine. Thank you very much. High-end builder Toll Brothers reported quarterly profits that beat expectations. Traders push shares up 3.8% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures' new comedy, The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, providing a full line of workforce printers designed for home offices, small offices, and networked work groups. Learn more at Epson.com. And by RingCentral, the cloud communications system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at ringcentral.com. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for January. The Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on The Coming Crisis, America's Dangerous Debt. And how many songs are in your playlist? 5 years ago tomorrow, iTunes hit a milestone. Apple announced that more than 10 billion songs had been downloaded. Over the next 3 years, that number more than doubled. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were telling you yesterday about the sorry state of education in the juvenile justice system. Marketplace's Adrian Hill went up to Wyoming to have a look at how they're adjusting to new federal guidelines that call for the kinds of educational technology that are common outside locked-up facilities. Today, the challenges of bringing computers and internet access into a big urban system with kids who've committed violent crimes. Adrian picks up the story in San Diego County.
San Diego's Kearny Mesa Juvenile Detention Facility feels a lot like an adult prison. Kids exercise in a courtyard surrounded by high fences and barbed wire. Probation officers, who double as security guards, keep close watch. In hallways, offenders are forbidden from making eye contact with adults. They turn and face the wall as we pass. Nearly every door has a heavy lock on it, including the classrooms. But behind these locked doors, that sense of powerlessness eases a little. In a social science class, kids discuss the tension between freedom and security, and the differences between ethos, pathos, and logos.
So when they use a word like, let's say something like threatening our freedoms, how does that sound?
That's pathos.
Why?
Because it's showing emotion.
And they're reading from and making notes on new laptops. Since July of 2013, San Diego County has spent nearly $900,000 on bringing computers, printers, and software into secure juvenile facilities. Soon, every one of the 200 kids here will have access to a Chromebook in class. All the teachers are being trained in adding tech to the curriculum. But getting to this point took more than a big investment. It took a significant culture shift.
At first, we were a little nervous, I'm not going to lie.
That's Mindy McCartney. She's one of the probation staff charged with keeping the youth here under control. Kids who've committed everything from petty crimes to murder.
Everybody thinks they're going to use it as a frisbee, or they're going to attack somebody, or they're going to tag it up or scratch it and break it. And it just simply hasn't really happened.
There was also anxiety about turning the internet on, even though there were firewalls and monitoring systems in place.
From a probation standpoint, we hear internet and access, and we automatically get very paranoid and think the worst case scenarios.
But so far, she says, they haven't had significant problems. Kids aren't using laptops as weapons. They're not sneaking messages to gang members on the outside. The teachers I spoke with say that technology has made their students more engaged, which is progress the juvenile justice system nationwide desperately needs to make. Peter Leone is a professor at the University of Maryland College of Education and a juvenile justice expert. He says, historically, education inside secure facilities...
It's been abysmal.
For years, the focus has been on punishing kids rather than teaching them.
You know, I've been to places where a significant number of the youth had no education services at all.
Facilities without full school days, or places where kids didn't earn credit for their work.
Because the correctional school was not approved by the state education agency to offer credit.
Many incarcerated kids enter the system already failing in school or far behind. When they leave, they're often worse off. Late last year, the federal government put out guidance making clear to states and school districts that locked up students have the right to a good education. Along with better teachers and more funding, the feds want to see more educational technology in juvenile justice facilities. San Diego is one of a growing number of places nationally attempting to make that happen.
And so when they're persuading us, when they're
in many ways, the promises of educational technology line up with the needs of kids in custody. Students who've committed crimes are constantly being yanked in and out of class.
Ethos, pathos, and logos. So let's look at this for a few minutes.
Alvarez and Barnes.
They have court hearings, meetings with probation officers.
We do have a population that moves around a lot.
Yolanda Collier teaches here. She says when students have their own computers and some lessons are online, kids don't have to fall behind.
If she wasn't here that day, I don't have to stand in front of the class and play a whole video over again. She can sit at her seat with her earphones and listen to the video and catch up on the information that she missed while we were while she was out of class.
Digital learning tools can also help overcome one of the toughest challenges in education at a juvenile facility. Teachers often have a classroom of students at all different grade levels. Students with learning disabilities, behavior problems, students with needs all over the map.
We're blended, so we have some direct instruction, some independent learning.
That's teacher Sarah Haffey.
Over here we have a young lady who is enrolled in community college online. So she's taking computer science.
Another girl is a month away from finishing high school. And there's Jocelyn, whose full name we won't use to protect her privacy. She's way behind both of them.
Well, I came in here with a little bit of credits because I wasn't going to school on the outs. So in here, I'm like really low on credits.
91% of kids who come into San Diego's facilities aren't reading at grade level. Many are a semester, even a year behind in school. Because like Jocelyn, they weren't going.
It feels good. Like, I feel like I'm able, like, I actually accomplished something. Like, in I earned like 40 to 50 credits in here as long as I've been here. So, I mean, that's a lot to me, and, like, I think it makes me feel, like, a sense of smartness, maybe, that I'm getting there.
It's too early to tell if San Diego's education experiment will pay off for the students. But there is one less obvious way. Technology's already made things better. Handing troubled kids computers sends a signal.
I think they feel valued. I think it shows that we value them and respect them.
That's teacher Jackie Smith.
I think that's why you don't see some of the things that was originally expected.
It's a sign, she says, that the institution is willing to invest in their future and that it's up to them to invest in it, too. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Come on, admit it. You've fantasized about chucking your job and following your passion, right? Whatever that might be. Dave Wiener actually did it, and he has not yet looked back. His bicycle company, Priority Bicycles, launched this past summer. Dave, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So you quit your job and you start a bicycle company. Seriously?
I've heard that one a lot, yeah. And, you know, now here I am at a point where I can say it loud and proud, but I quit my job running a tech company because I had this desire to bring my knowledge of supply chain, technology, and bicycles together to build a simpler bicycle.
How'd you do it? I mean, after you dropped that resignation letter on your boss's desk, then what?
Then I started, I had a business plan I'd written for the bicycle company, and I shopped it around to some friends and some trusted colleagues and started to get people's opinions and then started to get really scared. Mm-hmm. And then I just put my head down and worked, you know, 16-hour days every day. I brought on a partner who helped on the creative side, and we just worked incredibly hard to put together a product that we were really proud of with a value that hadn't been seen before in the market and with some smart engineering that was also new to the market. And that's how we got started, that and Kickstarter.
Yeah, well, we'll get to Kickstarter in a minute, but tell me about those 16-hour days. I mean, specifically, what did you do? Were you sourcing tires and figuring out who could make the frame? And I mean, were you down like at that level of detail?
Yeah, we dissected the bike, and we really wanted to go with simple, modern, classic, smart engineering.
Yeah.
So how can we make something that's low maintenance, that's lightweight, that's rather rust resistant, and started working with different manufacturers to say, how can we get a tire that's going to be more puncture resistant? The most noticeable feature on our bike is the belt drive. So that was the hardest part of the engineering is how do we get a belt instead of a chain?
Instead of a chain, yeah.
And so really went through each piece of the bike to figure out how to make it simpler, find partners that were willing to work with a startup.
Is that tough? Is that tough to find people who are willing to work with a startup? Because you can find bicycle frame makers all over the place, but I imagine some of them say, yeah, no, who are you?
Yeah, in order to get the volume and the quantity and the rates, it really is hard because the big bike manufacturers want to work with the big, well-established companies. Yeah. And so going in there and saying, hey, we're new, and we want you to work with us, and we also want this product to be incredibly cost-effective, was hard. So I did go back and forth all over the world, actually, sourcing parts on the bike. We have parts literally all across the world on the bike to make something that is free from routine maintenance, that looks good, and is a pleasure to ride.
At some point, you need capital, and you do what so many people do these days. You go to Kickstarter. And you did well.
Thank you.
I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Kickstarter was a dream come true. When we decided we were going to launch the company, I think my idea is a good idea. I had a partner who thought it was a good idea, but does the world think it's a good idea? Mm-hmm. And that's really where we went to Kickstarter and said, does our idea make sense? Do you like it as much as we do? And are you willing to help us with your money to get this company off the ground? And we had over 1,500 backers back us for bicycles. They all received their bicycles on time or early, and they're all happy.
Can I go to Manhattan today and see a Priority bike out there?
You can see them everywhere. We have bikes in all 50 states now. We have them in Canada, and there's a couple countries that we're opening up in the next few weeks, and some folks that have already started to import them on their own. So there's bikes. We've got pictures from Israel, from Italy, from Spain. People all over the world are riding them already just in a few months.
Dave Wiener, the company is Priority Bicycles. Dave, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, the line of the day, it goes to President Obama by way of the Marketplace desk of news we could have told you yesterday. I am hereby returning herewith, the president wrote, redundantly, I think, without my signature, S-1, the Keystone XL Pipeline Approval Act, which is the long and presidential way of saying veto. Also this from Brussels, Belgium. You will recognize the sound, I'm fairly sure. Yeah, that was a can. Kicked it down the road. Eurozone finance ministers rubber-stamped the Greek economic reforms that Athens promised to write down as a condition of the bailout extension they got last week, which means, cutting to the chase, we will be doing the Greek debt crisis dance once again come June.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses meet their goals with email and online marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times, prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Epson. Epson's smart point-of-sale solutions offers a new class of mobility to retail sales designed for improved customer service. Where there's business, there's Epson.
All right, that's all we got. We got to go. Caitlin Esch and Millie Jefferson are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.